Here is Los Angeles. James joining us, Independent Line.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Mr. Lake, I'm going to put you on the spot. I had email exchanges with General Petraeus that were covered all over the Internet. All you have to do is go to James Morris and General Petraeus and Google that. Mm-hmm. It conveyed that he was in cahoots with neocon warmonger Max Boot. Now, we just had a Washington Post article that came out that C-SPAN's completely ignored that talked about how the other neocon warmongers, Fred and Kimberly Kagan, were basically advising General Petraeus as well. Why aren't we talking about this on C-SPAN? And I'm going to, again, put you on the spot. Are you going to cover my email exchanges with General Petraeus?
Probably not. I haven't read them. What is this? I mean, seriously, the last time the neoconservatives had influence and real power would have probably been the end of the first George W. Bush term, when Paul Wolfowitz was the deputy defense secretary. And yet, there is, I think, a small minority of people on the internet who track the every movement of neoconservatives.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I am your host, Pierce Redman, and you can find this podcast and every other podcast I do by going to PorkinsPolicyReview.com. Well, today we are joined once again by our friend Robbie Martin. And for anyone that doesn't know, Robbie is, of course, the co-host of Media Roots Radio alongside Abby Martin. He is also the founder of Record Labels Records, and he's also a musician, and you can find all of his work at fluorescentgray.bandcamp.com. And, of course, Robbie is also a filmmaker, and we're going to be talking about a part two of his multi-part film, A Very Heavy Agenda. And part two is how we learn to stop worrying and love the new neocons. So we're going to get into all of that. Of course, Robbie and I spoke not that long ago on part one. But anyway, Robbie Martin, how are you?
I'm great. How are you, Pierce?
I'm doing good. Excellent. I'm really excited to be talking again with you, and especially about A Very Heavy Agenda. We had a great response to our first podcast, and I think people are going to be really excited to see part two of this. But Robbie, why don't you kind of give us the overview, give us the sort of news, soundbite. What is A Very Heavy Agenda part two about?
Well, I'll give a multi-tier synopsis. So for those people who have seen part one, it's essentially a continuation of part one. So part one of a very heavy agenda ends with basically the formation of the Foreign Policy Initiative, which is a rebranded version of the most infamous neoconservative think tank in D.C., the Project for the New American Century. And then part two, it sort of starts off at that point. Where are we sort of now that these neocons have rebranded themselves, and what kind of damage are they doing now? When I say now, I mean sort of a recent time frame of the past, like 3 years. So most of the content in part two takes place between maybe late 2012 and going all the way up until late 2014. So very, very recent stuff. And it focuses mainly on the new neocons. It's kind of a redundant wording, since neocons means new, like new conservative, someone who used to be liberal who turned conservative. That's sort of the literal definition of it. But I guess in the title, I'm using it more like who are sort of the new people, the new generation of people who are sort of carrying the torch of people like Bill Kristol, Robert Kagan. And what you see happening in part two is that not only are the old neocons back and somehow invited on television and treated basically with total respect, that they also have a whole group of new minions who are essentially doing the bidding for them. And a lot of these people may just be careerist, like they want to sort of curry favor with the neocons, because if in reality there really aren't that many of them. And that's what's interesting to me about it is you could maybe count like 20 people total who are really active and really doing this kind of damage. And the damage is essentially greasing the skids for war, or apologizing for our sort of like U.S. military interventions and coming up with new reasons and new excuses for ways that we should wage war in different countries. And some of these people, I mean, I mean, some of the, I guess, the new neocons, some of them might not even really have much of a like a hardcore neoconservative ideology, but they're sort of like reporting on things and reporting in a vein that sort of the neocons would like. And the neocons publicize them. The Foreign Policy Initiative's newsletter, they call it the I forgot the name of the actual newsletter, but if you read it, you'll see a mixture of sort of old guard neocons. They'll run articles by people like Richard Perle, David Frum, and then in the newsletter they'll actually throw in articles from Vice and BuzzFeed and Daily Beast from people like Josh Rogan and Eli Lake and Miriam Elder and Rosie Gray. So you see this sort of like this new and old guard joining forces, And I try as best as I can in part two. I know you asked for a short synopsis, and I'm giving you a really long one already. But I mean, what you see happen in part two is it almost appears from the surface. You know, we can't see inside of the administration. We could only really speculate, you know, from what we know, what's leaked out of it and stuff. But it appears that at a certain point, the neocons were completely on board with Obama's foreign policy. They were totally behind him until Syria, and specifically until he decided to sort of reverse this posturing of a full military invasion of Syria based on Assad allegedly attacking his own people with chemical weapons. And after that moment, there was a split off where by all appearances, it seems like the neocons are almost acting as this outside agitator force. And in a weird way, I mean, I'm not giving any excuse to Obama by saying this. I hope it doesn't come off that way. But in a weird way, it almost does seem like he has lost control of the asylum. The asylum being sort of like DC as a whole. And now it almost seems like he is sort of like. So what's happening now is Obama appears to be dragging his feet ever so slightly on certain things that if there was maybe a different president in office, or if he was even more sympathetic to the neocons still, we would already be seeing like a full equipping of the Ukrainian army with U.S. military equipment. And so far we have not seen that, even though the Congress voted overwhelmingly twice on that. So there are just some things like that in the movie that I hope people will pick up on. And, you know, I almost treat Obama in the movie like a ghost, like he's kind of, you know, there are some moments where he's talking, but he just sounds so scripted and so not plugged into what's going on. Like almost like he's just not present, you know, like the level of anxiety and, you know, I mean, 'cause what does it really mean to reignite, not a literal Cold War, but sort of like this Cold War posturing with Russia again, so long after the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, I don't even really know if people in the White House were able to fully process what they allowed to happen and what's going to continue once they leave. Like, this is not it's not going to get all wrapped up all nicely once Obama leaves office, and it's going to be like, okay, now we're going to reset this. You know, reset it again.
Yeah.
I mean, we're way beyond that point now.
I think that's an excellent point. And as you said, you make that early on, and you do see that where, especially on something like Ukraine, Obama seems way out of his depth. Like, he doesn't fully understand what's going on. And again, yeah, very much that the neocons just kind of, you know, they see this opening. You know, and you have some great lines from Bill Kristol where he's talking about how, he loves Obama's foreign policy, and he calls him a born again neocon.
yeah.
Which is interesting because, you know, this coming from, you know, all of the sort of the old guard and the new guard neocons, they never use that phrase. You know, it's sort of like it doesn't exist. There were no neocons. You know, there were maybe one or two, but they were insignificant. They never use that. But there you see Bill Kristol on like CNN or ABC, something like that.
It was openly. Red Eye.
Yeah. Oh, yes. It was yeah. Red. Yeah. With the gut feel, that idiot. Yeah, exactly. And he's saying, oh, he's a born again neocon. And then, of course, I'm sure Bill Kristol forgot that, you know, that phrase ever existed if you asked him now. But yeah, it does seem very much that there was this opening and they kind of infiltrated in and they start, you know, poking and prodding and kind of pushing certain people. And then, of course, you know, you get big neocons like John McCain going and, you know, speaking to all of these Ukrainian protesters, you know, alongside neo-Nazis.
Yeah.
And that kind of amps up everything. But yeah, I loved it when you sort of point out that, you know, Obama can love him or hate him, he can speak very well. But when it comes to something like Ukraine, I mean, it's like he's reading, you know, he's got cue cards over there, you know, teleprompter. He can't really articulate any sort of real thoughts on that.
Absolutely.
So that's a very interesting point. And I know, again, you know, so many people in alt media will talk about how the president doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But, you know, they're, Obama this, Obama that. And it is kind of like, yeah, it doesn't matter because he's not controlling ultimately what's going on in Ukraine. This is like well beyond his purview. And of course, I mean, then you focus quite a bit in this documentary on Victoria Nuland, who we spoke about the last time we talked.
Yeah.
Very much. You know, hands-on, on the ground, you know, orchestrating things and color revolutions. So, you know, yeah, again, really, I think that's an important point to make early on. And another thing that, again, that I found really fascinating that I think gets overlooked when discussing the neoconservative agenda is that it's very easy to lump this as, oh, this is all about Israel, or, you know, this is about some sort of, you know, a Zionist agenda. And certainly that's a big factor in it. I mean, let's be honest. Most of the old guard neocons are, you know, we would consider them Zionists, or at least in that they 100% fall, you know, lockstep with the whole agenda of Israel. But I think that's in part a smokescreen. I think that's in part it's a convenient way to get their message across. You know, there's a lot of people out there that want to defend Israel no matter what, and it's a great way to kind of lump in a lot of other agendas that might be going on. But, you know, as you rightly point out, they loved Obama up until the gas attack in Ghouta, which, again, if anyone's paying attention in Turkey right now, there are a couple very prominent politicians that are talking about what really went on. They're also talking about a couple of interesting court cases in Turkey where, you know, it was alleged in open court and then quietly shut down that, yeah, the gas was coming from Turkey, from the Turkish government, that they constructed these bombs in Turkey and then smuggled them into Ghouta. But it wasn't so much even that that he gassed people. It was that Obama went to Putin and asked him to help negotiate, to help basically make Assad give up all these weapons. That was the real red line. And I think that ultimately
the red line for the neocons, you mean.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that that ultimately that's what this is really about, and it illustrates all of the kind of masks and agendas and ideas that the neocons will you know, shroud themselves in, be it Israel or Muslim terrorism or, you know, whatever. It really is ultimately about Russia. This has always been about Russia. You know, you can look at things like, you know, the original Operation Gladio. What is this? We're using right-wing fascists to attack leftists, ultimately Russia. You know, Gladio B, we're using Islamic terrorists to attack Russia and to a lesser extent China to destabilize them. This is what the neocons are really obsessed about. It's not, to me at least, it's not about greater Israel or those sort of things. Those are great. If we can get that, sure. But ultimately what this is really about is confronting Russia. And as you point out in numerous news clips in this documentary, these neocons are wetting themselves at the prospect of a Cold War. They love this. They speak fondly about the Cold War. And they talk about these like sort of crazy ideas that like, oh, it was great when the Soviet Union was around because then there was, you know, there was balance in the galaxy or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, as if that's not the case right now. I mean, you know, and again, they're phrasing that in the sense that America is being dominated by Russia. You know, that we need to confront them so that we can create these two superpowers as if they don't already exist. But I think, you know, again, and then once the sort of Russia card is initially played, the neocons just go hog wild. And then we see this, you know, this birth of all of these, like James Kirchick and, as you said, Rosie Gray, Eli Lake, Josh Rogan. The list goes on. We'll get into some of our favorite neocon spokesmen in a little bit. But you also talk about very much how this is also a media war. And I think that's really what's important about what's going on right now. If you're at all concerned about the neocon agenda, it is very much a war based in the media. You point out that Bill Kristol is there's this war weariness. You know, people don't want to go and slaughter people overseas. And again, you know, Bill Kristol never spent a day of his life in the military. He would never go. He would never send his children or anybody like that, any of his loved ones. He's not going to ship them off to Afghanistan or, you know, Yemen or any other place that we were involved in. So I think it's fitting that instead of that, and obviously the neocons, they're not, at least for right now, with the exception of people like Victoria Nuland and to an extent Robert Kagan and others, there aren't neocons in the White House. They're not, you know, running the State Department or other groups the way that they were, say, under Bush. So they're... ultimate goal, as I see it, and as you kind of lay out in the film, we have to get involved in the media because, you know, through the media, we can kind of convince people of anything that we want. And, you focus a lot on the real scumbag, James Kirchick. And maybe we can kind of expand out a little bit of some stuff, you know, involving Abby, your sister. Comments that she made, and then how James Kirchick kind of jumped in there. And we can talk about Liz Wahl also, who's another character that I absolutely despise. But it's very interesting how, again, they saw this opening, and then they took it, and they ran with it. And again, if for anyone that doesn't know, we're referring to when Abby Martin still was doing Breaking the Set with Russia Today, you know, she expressed her own opinion that what was going on in Crimea was wrong, that, you know, military aggression, whether it's from Russia or from America or from Syria or whatever country, doesn't really matter. It's always wrong. And she was sort of, you know, saying this is crazy and I'm not going to kind of promote it. And then for a minute it was, this is great. You know, here's this person at the, you know, the Kremlin's propaganda arm talking about, you know, she's expressing her opinion and Putin's not firing her. But then, yeah, you know, almost overnight, James Kirchick and others, but particularly the scumbag Kirchick, he goes on every media outlet that will take him talking about how, but she's crazy. She's a truther. You know, she's into 9/11 truth. And so that makes her crazy. RT is crazy. She didn't really say anything that's all that damaging or whatnot. And then again, enter Liz Wahl, who publicly resigns on air. And you can just see her reading this script. It's horrible. And so I don't know, Robbie, why don't you kind of explain that out a bit? Because I think that is a great example of how this media war kind of got started.
Yeah, I wanted to, before I do that, I wanted to just respond to one of the things you said about when you mentioned John McCain. Because what was a big surprise to me when I first started making this was that John McCain is absolutely at the forefront of sort of this neocon push. And I just didn't realize, or I maybe wasn't paying attention closely enough to what he was all about, but it's very clear that at this point in time, at least, he is completely devoted to like Project for the New American Century and sort of that specific neocon agenda, 100%. Even as you mentioned, going as far as actually going on the ground in Euromaidan Square and rallying the anti-government protesters. And so, you know, there's little things in the movie that I think people might be surprised by, like that. because, you know, as far as I remember, John McCain was always kind of one of those senators who would kind of just blow in the wind. He was doing things that for a while where Republicans hated him. You know, they thought he was just kind of like a too much of a Democrat lackey. There's another side of John McCain that people really need to look at, because this is a guy who is, in my mind at least, more plugged in. If you're looking at someone outside the White House who's in government, he in my mind sort of rises to the top of sort of this power structure. So that's a totally other side of it. But this backstory, I mean, what you just mentioned about Jamie Kirchick and Abby and Liz Wall, I mean, if that didn't happen, there's a possibility I would not even have heard of the Foreign Policy Initiative.
Right,
I might not even be aware of what's going on. I mean, in a way, that's how subtle it is that I wasn't paying, you know, I feel like in sort of my day to day, I pay some attention to this kind of stuff. But this was a total surprise to me when it happened. I mean, first, you know, Abby decided to speak out on her show. And it wasn't because she was that even that strongly in disagreement with sort of like the response that Russia had. And when I say that, I mean that like it was understandable to us, like why sort of Russia was doing it. Not that we agreed with it, but it wasn't like it definitely was not as egregious as, say, the America invading Iraq. I mean, not even close, you know, like so. Right. So that just put that out there. But so in her mind, what she was mostly upset by, and I actually wanted some of the only like original content that's not archival footage in the movie, is an interview with her that I did where she sort of explains in detail why she decided to do it. And it was mostly because she felt RT's coverage was becoming too slanted and too like pro sort of the sort of Russian angle in that situation. And as someone who has spent many years doing media critique and critiquing propaganda, she was very like sort of turned off by RT sort of flipping that switch, even if it was for a very short period of time when they did that. And once again, it was not as bad as our media was when something like the Iraq war happened. It had maybe very slightly similar hints to that, but you know, I mean, that was really it. That was really what she was alarmed by. She didn't want to be represented by sort of that style of media. And when I say style of media, I mean, she remembers being in the studio of RT watching, I think it was like an RT International broadcast of people handing cookies and flowers to Russian soldiers. And that really pissed her off. And I could totally understand that, you know, because up until that point, she was, you know, she was generally okay with, you know, the situation. She knew she was working for a Russian television channel. She knew that at some point she might encounter something like where she would have had to take a different stance than what the rest of the network was taking, or, and you know, something like that. So when she did this, she had no idea that it was going to have the impact that it did. Little did she know is that there were basically people in the media and these neocons outside of the White House that were poised to basically try to take down the network RT itself. And up until that point, people virtually ignored the network's existence. I mean, RT was running, I think it was running since 2007, possibly even earlier. So I'd say for at least 4 years, the media here and the U.S. government ignored, pretended like RT didn't even exist. And that was sort of their way of dealing with it. But when Abby made this statement, I think inadvertently it created this opening where she got, you know, attention in the press because people wanted to hail her as some kind of anti-Russian hero, which was absolutely absurd if you know anything about Abby's politics, which I suspect they did not, and that's why they you know, the just like the beheading hoax that I did, the media, one thing I learned from that is the media is extremely quick to run with something. It's all about speed. It's all about getting there first. It's all about the scoop. It's less about fact checking, less about like actual investigative reporting. So someone could have looked at what her politics were and seen that she was extremely radical, you know, on the left, extremely anti-US militarism, military intervention. They didn't bother. Jamie Kirchick, this fellow at the Foreign Policy Initiative, he probably already knew a little bit about what she was about. I'm sure two people like neocons in DC, they probably knew a little bit about who Abby was, and they probably fucking hated her. I mean, you know, because she's the opposite of what they're about. So I think that it was a perfect opportunity. And literally within 24 hours of her statement, he went on MSNBC, and essentially tried to like destroy her. He threw every smear at the book at her. You know, he implied she was an anti-Semite, insane. He even compared her to like John Bircher society, like that she, you know, that she did a thing about fluoride on her show, which actually, if you watch the segment, was like completely rational. It wasn't saying that it's a conspiracy or anything. It was just saying like, do we really want like basically what is fertilizer runoff inserted into our water. It's not, and Abby and I have talked about this on the show. It's a Media Roots. It's not like the fluoride put into our water supply is like pharmaceutical grade, like dental, you know, like,
no, that's a big thing to point out to people.
Yeah. It's an actual fucking byproduct of fertilizer production. So it's just, and that's what she was talking. She even shows like a graphic on her show showing where they put the little, you know, the runoff or the fertilizer and all that stuff. So he completely misrepresented her. And like a lot of times that happens, nobody's really, you know, that's all that people will notice. They'll hear him smearing her, hear him saying these things, and then, you know, assume that they're true. A lot of people probably didn't even look into what she was about. So you could probably hear the tone in my voice right now. I mean, it is definitely like obviously a personal story for me because it's my sister. But then I'm also, you know, I've always had sort of a passing interest in the neocons, and sort of like at this point, these two worlds collided for me in a weird way where I was just like, wow, you know, this is strange that this sort of neocon guy, he's a fellow at the Foreign Policy Initiative, and you know, it didn't take me too long to find out that was the project for the New American Century, simply under a different name, and that he must be doing this because he has some kind of agenda, you know. But I guess at the time I didn't extrapolate it really beyond that, because I was just like, well, he just probably really hates my sister's politics, he's using this opportunity to take her down, you know. I left it at that. But then the next day was sort of when everything sort of became very clear. And that was when Liz Wahl, one of Abby's colleagues at the network, she actually resigned live on television because she said she could not work at a Putin-funded network any longer that whitewashes the actions of Putin. And she proceeded to give this bizarre patriotic speech that was clearly, you know, not, I'm not going to say that she didn't write any of it, but I'll say that she definitely had someone help her write the majority of that speech, obviously. So, and then of course this, she got media attention from this, but the difference was, between her and Abby is that Abby basically got smeared in the media, right after she made sort of her stand, because of being a truther and all this other stuff. Liz Wahl sort of took the opposite approach as like a pro-American, anti-Russian, sort of like I can't take it anymore. Like I'm just too patriotic and like to care too much about my country, you know, to allow myself to work at a Putin-funded network any longer. And from there, it ballooned out into this thing where now Russia Today had all this negative media attention coming towards it. I mean, it was now Russia Today was in the spotlight. You can find hundreds of hit pieces and really hyperbolic critiques of RT from around this time, from people like Rosie Gray and other people at BuzzFeed and The Daily Beast. And then Jamie Kirchick, of course, did this stunt where he went to the RT offices in D.C. and was like harassing people coming in and out of the building. And if you've ever been to RT, you know that it shares a building with like 30 other clients that are completely unrelated to RT. So he's there arguing with the security guard about basically because he's harassing everybody walking out of the building. Now, he wrote a extremely fictional story to this. I didn't even put this in my movie because it's not – it's kind of more of a side thing. But he wrote a story with the headline Putin TV called The Cops on Me.
Right.
And in the story, he claims that RT called the police and had them like come and talk to him. But in reality, the security guard for the building was so annoyed by this guy that he called the police. And the security guard who runs the building has not a fucking thing to do with RT. He's just running
he's
the
just
building.
A security guard, yeah.
Yeah, just like anybody else running the security at a building. So not only was the story just complete bullshit, it was just a total – it reminded me of the same type of shit that like James O'Keefe and some of these like other AstroTurf-style – like conservative rabble rousers do, you know, like kind of just creating like a fake story out of nothing. And then while he was outside of RT, just magically this group of anti-Russian Ukrainian protesters holding a big banner comes up to the front of the network and starts protesting. Like, really?
Yeah.
Like, come on, dude. Like, you, clearly this is coordinated. Like, no one even knows where RT is. It's like an unmarked building. That looks totally innocuous. It looks like any other building. So not to get too distracted, but yeah, that whole situation was just so mind-blowing to me. And then to later find out that, you know, Jamie Kirchick put her up to this. Jamie Kirchick was the one who convinced her to resign live on TV on that day. And the reason why he did is because my sister sort of created this opening inadvertently, and he took it. I mean, almost like a hyena. I mean, he ran for it and took it, and it sort of how do I say this? I guess it Jamie Kirchick used it to sort of write a bunch of pieces about Russia. Eli Lake was writing a bunch of pieces about Russia around the same time. And then it all became this sort of like funny conspiracy theory that they were making fun of, that you know, then they started mocking the idea that this was in any way coordinated or pre-planned or anything like that. But that sort of rationale and sort of like trying to brush off what had really happened, I think they weren't able to do that as much after Rania and Max Blumenthal wrote the piece, basically laying out in detail that the Foreign Policy Initiative knew in advance of Liz Wahl's resignation, and they actually tweeted it online
exactly.
20 minutes before it happened. Now, Jamie Kirchick's excuse and his explanation for that is, oh, I was running social media that day at Foreign Policy Initiative because he worked there. But once again, why would they – be the ones to deliver that information? Why wouldn't he just be the one? Like, why wouldn't he tweet that? My thought on that is the Foreign Policy Initiative wanted almost to like start a psychological sort of like mind fuck kind of a war with Russia on their own sort of terms, almost like on their own turf. Like, yeah, the US government, you know, might be not have a backbone or might not be like as aggressive with you, but we're going to be
right.
Like, kind of, and I think it was designed to send a message to RT and the Russia at large, and sort of a, you know, and it may sound a little crazy to say that, but that's really the only reason I can think of that they tweeted that, because you know, a lot of the times neocons, it's actually kind of rare of them, I think, to reveal their hand like that, and that was one time where they really, it was almost like they wanted people to know,
we're
in
back.
Some way, yeah. 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 And that's really the only way I can explain it. I mean, I can't say exactly who was coaching her, if it was, you know, who besides Jamie Kirchick or if it was just Jamie Kirchick. But it's clear that that this was a stunt that they pulled, and in most ways it was actually a really successful stunt that had an impact. I don't think the general public even looked beyond the headlines. Most people probably think Liz Wahl is legit. Most people I even bring this up to, they confuse Abby with Liz Wahl. I mean, that's how like little of this actual the real story was able to sort of get out to the general public. Most people didn't know the real story. And they only knew that Liz Wahl resigned from RT because she couldn't handle working there anymore. It was propaganda, you know, and she was a hero. And like I said, this is what got me sort of kickstarted to make this movie in the first place. Was I was sort of, you know, with my sister, you know, talking to her on the phone. I was at her apartment as this was going down. And it was sort of like I kind of got this like fly on the wall view of like sort of as this drama unfolded. And what her and I could really only describe as like something that you would only see in the show House of Cards or something. Like it's just something that you normally don't get to experience or witness, you know, as someone other than just like a complete outside observer. So it was very surreal for me.
Well, and also just to point out, you know, Jamie Kirchick will go on and on about, they're just working for, you know, propaganda, blah, blah, blah. When this guy made his career working for RFERL, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, the CIA State Department's premier propaganda outlet, you know, and he'll admit it, but he's, you know, but it's different. It's different when I do it. And also, again, Liz Wahl, former Fox intern for Sean Hannity, who you know, after 2 years of working at RT, finally realized, oh damn, this is a state funded, you know, pro Russian media outlet. Oh God, I got to get out of here. And you know, and like you said, Kirchick is tweeting this stuff out a few days after that. Where is Liz Wahl? Oh, actually, it was that day. There's a picture of Liz Wahl and Jamie Kirchick together. Yeah. And then a few days after that, it's a picture of Liz Wahl, Jamie Kirchick, Eli Lake, and Rosie Gray all hanging out together. So yeah, the idea that this is, you know, just all coincidences is such a joke. And just a couple little things. There's two interesting things in the film, in some of the interviews with Abby, where she said, one, she referred, and I think rightfully so, refers to Liz Wahl as a mole. That she was, her whole purpose was to go there and then to create some stunt. Because, you know, she said Liz Wahl never expressed any opinion. They knew each other. She never expressed anything about Russia, you know, previously. You know, and not to be rude, but I mean, she just seems like she's just kind of a, you know, she's just a newscast. She's just there to read the news. She's not, you know, doing any hard-hitting reports. But the, you know, at the same time, she said that everything she did there was Putin propaganda. So, and Abby points out, so all of the reporting she did on Chelsea Manning, that was Russian propaganda, you know, which is another bold, you know, so, oh, okay. So, you know, Chelsea Manning being treated horribly in prison, oh, that, who cares? That's just Russian propaganda. It's fine. You know, and of course, Jamie Kirchick, famous for going on RT to talk about his, you know, horrific article where he, you know, he called for Manning to be, I think, he, you know, he thought executed. Manning should be, executed. But he goes on to talk about, you know, Russia's persecution of homosexuals in Russia. You know, I guess overlooking the fact that, you know, Chelsea Manning kind of fit, you know, falls into the same LGBT group. So, you know, that I found that really interesting. And again, this concept that, you know, yeah, Liz Wahl was, her task, get into RT, and then, you know, have this thing. And where's she working now? The Blaze, of all places.
Yeah, and I think she already got fired from there, actually. Like, temporary.
Yeah.
But I wanted to interject on what you said about, I think that's a really important point you just raised about how he came on RT to protest the Russian gay law when basically coming on to talk about the inhumane treatment of Chelsea Manning. And this is all the way back when, you know, he she was referred to as Bradley Manning. So like, but I think at the time it was like, there was sort of evidence, or that was sort of known that, that there was possibility that she might transition or that she was transgender. There was something in the Adrian Lamo transcripts about, yes, that she didn't feel like she was in the right body and things like that. So it was already sort of well known that, that there was a potential, at least. And I think even for people like you and me, maybe we thought, you know, maybe this person could be sort of like people in the LGBT movement would stand behind them, because they are sort of like, you know, it's one of the first times an LGBT person has been in this position, has like blown the whistle on the US government and is like in jail, basically. So at least for me, I was kind of thinking, well, maybe there, you know, there's a possibility, like, you know, someone like Dan Savage, who's very liberal, or some other sort of very liberal but prominent voices in the LGBT community would stand up for Chelsea Manning. But it turned out that Jamie Kirchick's role during that period of time, I think that him protesting the gay law was almost like a side mission. And his real mission during that period was essentially to break the connection between support for Chelsea Manning and the LGBT community. He was there sort of as a person to stop that and to yell from a megaphone, hey, look, I'm LGBT and this person is not a hero. They're a traitor. Like, don't buy into this idea. And if you look back at his articles, he actually influenced Dan Savage to write sort of like a rejecting the idea that they should support Chelsea Manning. And I remember that reading that in The Stranger years ago and thinking, that's really pisses me off that Dan Savage would sort of openly express like his non-support for this, you know? And I found out later that it was because he was so inspired by Jamie Kirchick's stunt on RT and his writings. And I was blown away by that, thinking, wow, like there's a gay neocon who's actually advocating for the death of this whistleblower and who's inspiring and influencing other people in the LGBT community who probably weren't that politically smart or had much of a backbone to begin with. I don't know if you've seen it, but Dan Savage actually openly advocated in The Stranger for the Iraq War back in 2003.
Yes.
Yeah. So the guy is kind of a piece of shit. I think a lot of people assume that he's very liberal. He's very sexually, you know, open and kind of like risque. But I think that was Jamie Kirchick's like second big thing that he did. The first one being the main person to spread around the racist Ron Paul newsletters back in 2008 while he was working for the New Republic. And I sort of look at that as that was sort of another neocon mission that he was sent on, not because he cared that Ron Paul had racist views in this newsletter back in the 90s, but because Ron Paul was an extremely prominent, possibly the most prominent anti-war figure at that time period in the country. So that was the reason why Jamie Kirchick went after him.
Ron Paul would use the phrase neocon all the time.
Oh, constantly. Yeah. Constantly. Yeah. And recently his son started saying it. And when he was actually asked what he meant or who he meant by neocons, he wouldn't say. Now, I think that actually illustrates something very scary, that if Rand Paul is afraid to name these names now, why is that? I think that's because in some ways they're almost more powerful and more sort of like they dominate the landscape in DC even maybe more than they did when Ron Paul was there. You know, even though Bush was in office and a lot of neocons were in his administration, I do not think that they sort of had the influence overall that they have now, where in a lot of ways it's normalized.
I think that's a big part of what you talk about in the film. And that was, you know, my biggest question that I had after watching the film is, why is no one even talking about this? First off, why is Bill Kristol even allowed to be on television anymore. I mean, the guy, he's just so full of shit. You know, and he's so flippant towards, you know, don't be tired of war. It's good. You know, and all these sort of like awful, awful statements. And it's not just him. I mean, same Dan Senior, Robert Kagan, you know, you play the clip of Richard Pearl on CNN, C-SPAN, saying the neocons don't exist. They never existed. So it's sort of, you know, it's why no one is talking about this. They're all back, the old ones. And then even more so, this rebranding, you're just saying how, you know, Rand Paul is afraid to talk about this. And I think in part it's because they've gone from a sort of, you know, fringe group of people into basically all the big mainstream media, you know, the new outlets, all these like hip news like Vice or BuzzFeed, you know, the Daily Beast, they're kind of everywhere and they don't fit the same mold as this sort of old school neocon. You know, as you said, you know, Eli Lake, Josh Rogan, you know, Rosie Gray obviously is you know, she's just a hipster who writes for BuzzFeed. She, you know, she has that sort of, you know, hipster street cred, but then she writes these insane articles that, I mean, come, you know, straight out of Bill Kristol's mouth.
Yeah.
And you know, expanding that out a little bit, the same thing, Vice News, again, will portray itself. They masquerade as this like hip alternative newspaper or magazine, whatever. Again, I believe at this point, you know, they're now 30% owned by Walt Disney. So, you know, very hip and cool. But more so, I mean, all of their foreign policy coverage is just supporting the NATO agenda. You know, you Absolutely. Had, Shane Smith, you know, going to Libya to go, you know, yeah, let's go hang out with the fucking rebels, man. This is, you know, this is the real, you know, Vice News. And, you know, he's hanging out with people who, you know, when the cameras are off, they're locking up black Libyans in cages in zoos and executing them. You know, these are not cool people to be associating themselves with. But, you know, they've expanded out into this sort of diverse group that is controlling foreign policy and even more importantly, the media. And maybe we can kind of we can talk about that a little bit, Robbie, because there, you know, we've been mentioning people like Eli Lake and Josh Rogan. I mean, that shouldn't come as much of a surprise. Eli Lake has always been, you know, a neocon, even if he wants to, you know, go again on C-SPAN and say that they don't exist, that they've never had any power, or that they only had a brief bit of power during, you know, George W. Bush's campaign. Yeah. But, you know, Eli Lake, Jamie Kirchick, these are kind of the more, or Jamie Kirchick especially, he's just an idiot. You know, Jamie Kirchick just does whatever he's told. But you focus on some of the more, you know, intellectually savvy people within this sort of this new neocon journalist clique. And particularly Peter Pomerantsev is a really interesting character he's British, you know, so a little bit, you know, removed, I guess, from the sort of DC clique. But at the same time, this guy is pushing all of the big sort of like anti-Russian propaganda. And he talks particularly about RT. And let me just say, anyone that's been listening to my podcast knows I don't really like RT. I think it is essentially now it's just become Russian CNN. You know, it's just every – I was just watching RT before we started talking, and I was like – it was some new show. You know, they've got all of the – they got like a new show every week that no one pays attention to. And yeah, I mean, it has become basically just everything Russia does is great. but all the same, Peter Pomerantsev talks about RT and these like, you know, everything Russia does is a psyop. It's a psyop. You know, and he talks about their – you know, in these very sort of – you know, hoity-toity intellectual phrases that I think he comes off as he's a real smart guy. You know, this guy is he understands media culture and Russian psyops and all these sort of things. And you have him in, I believe it was a lecture he did at the Foreign Policy Initiative, and he's talking about all these sort of things. And then he, you know, this little throwaway line where, RT is the worst propaganda thing out there, but their model is the model that we're all going to be using. All, you know, he says something to the effect of like, all media will be like RT.
Oh, like he's worried. Yeah, he's worried that because RT is using such a scary model that everybody's going to start using it in the future. But it's mm-hmm. like he's obviously I mean, he's not dumb. That's the thing. I mean, yeah, he's exactly. Like you said, he's very intellectually savvy. So when he says things like that, I think that, like Mark Ames says, his naivety is very like risible. He acts like he knows less than he obviously does. Like anybody will tell you who's followed media for the past 8 years that sort of the internet created a situation and sort of like the sort of Fox News sensationalistic kind of like method of doing news. Everyone's already adopted that. People mm-hmm. are pushing the envelope on it all the time. I mean, like I was saying, like James O'Keefe, you know, he does these some of the most sensationalistic, like fake AstroTurf kind of journalism. He'll dress up in a Bin Laden mask and yeah. and swim through the Rio Grande, you know, and act like he just did this like breaking story. So, I mean, it's like it's very interesting when you hear him talk. And I think what is the most interesting part about when I hear Peter Pomerantsev talk about that the psyops and how Russia is waging this information war is that not only can most of the things he's saying be applied more to the United States than Russia, it almost seems like he is riffing on some of like almost like the oversimplified, myopic, more conspiracy theorist mindset that people have here about our own government. That the U.S. government is is continuously launching these media psyops, which they have. you know, not to say that they haven't done that, but that they're doing it all the time. And sort of the way he talks about NGOs and phase one operations, that's sort of the way that you know, that the more paranoid people in America imagine that we do wage foreign policy in these other countries, and we have done that. So, but the way he's describing it is sort of like the balls to the wall version of like a conspiracy theorist here who thinks that like every time there's anything happening in any country, it's because the U.S. has inserted some kind of NGO or fostered regime change, like no matter what it is. Like that's how he's talking about the Russian system and what they're doing. And that's it's very fascinating to me because there's multiple things in his book. I haven't read his whole book, but I've read the paper he did with Michael Rice. I've read sections of his book. You can preview parts of it online. He writes like an American conspiracy theorist. And mm-hmm. I personally believe that he is very inspired by the conspiracy theory culture here. And it's almost like he's turning what Robert Anton Wilson did with the Illuminatus trilogy, but actually inverting what that trilogy was meant to do. Like, that trilogy was almost meant to like sort of help hippies and people who got sucked into like speed and other hard drug culture, like to get them kind of like sucked out of like that everything is a conspiracy. Because a lot of hippies sort of went down that road in the 70s where they got like really paranoid, and his book series is almost kind of like riffing on that and acting like, you know, that it's sort of like creating like a fantasy novel out of that concept. Peter Pomerantsev is almost like playing on that, but actually like using it to pretend that this is the reality. Like sort of like playing on paranoia or speculation that people already do, and then like painting an entire narrative with that and saying, yeah, this is what Russia does. Like, and it really does echo of like 1950s and 60s Cold War propaganda from the United States. Like, this is what Russian people are like.
Yes.
This is what their children are like. Like, it really does remind me of that. It's just a more sophisticated, more 2015 kind of version of that. And it's fascinating to me. I mean, like, I can't even say that I like hate or like he makes me, you know, like someone like Jamie Kirchick, Eli Lake, like they piss me off on like a gut level.
Yes.
Someone like him is more just like, wow, I can learn from this because this is clearly like a new model of neocon propaganda. That's not really, in my mind, has never really been done before, like in this sort of new push for the Cold War. Or even, you know, even during the Iraq War, there weren't that many really intellectual people who were appealing in the same way Peter Pomerantsev was to, you know, to intellectuals. Like maybe Hitchens was kind of, but he was way too like, you know, like real and like angry, you know, and like he definitely turned off a lot of liberals. But I guess what I'm saying is it's a new type of neocon propaganda, that, that I think more people are going to start adopting in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that, and again, that's what's so fascinating. And, you know, what people are really going to come away when they watch your film is the level to which they have expanded the sort of scope of what a neocon can be.
Yeah.
You know, they've taken, obviously Jamie Kirchick is just a little, you know, shitbag. You know, he's just a bulldog. He's there to yell and to complain. And again, he's there to be the sort of the hypocrite. You know, he's going to, he's put out there, he's going to complain and bitch and moan about RT as propaganda when he obviously knows real propaganda too, because he's worked for RFERL. But same thing. Rosie Gray is just, she's just a silly writer for BuzzFeed. You know, Eli Lake, Josh Rogan, it's sort of like, you know, their journalistic articles are basically just op-ed pieces.
Yeah.
You know, and that's fine. But then you get Peter Pomerantsev, you get Elliot Higgins at Bellingcat, the Brown Moses blog, Michael Weiss. These people are, they're savvy, they're intelligent. They can speak in a way and they can come to they can speak to the intellectual crowd, they can speak to the kind of tech savvy hipster crowd that seems to love, you know, that, you know, all Elliot Higgins does is just look at Google Earth, but somehow that's, oh, he's so cool and technically, you know, savvy and whatnot. And they can, and also they're appealing to the sort of liberal interventionist type people, and they're kind of sucking them into this sort of neocon umbrella group, and it's very interesting, you know, when some of the Peter Pomerantsev stuff, and he's talking about, oh, you know, Russia uses the media and they use NGOs as these weaponized forms of information warfare, and, you know, and you cut back to speech that a parliament member was giving in Ukraine talking about Tech Camp, which was a State Department initiative where they were basically showing all these people in Ukraine, and Tech Camp has recently popped up in Kyrgyzstan as well, you know, how to use the media as a weapon, how to, you know, control the narrative, to do all of these sort of things. And this guy is openly saying, you know, the embassy in Kiev is funding these people. They are fomenting and controlling a coup d'etat here. You know, while Peter Pomerantsev is saying, oh, but, you know, it's really the Russians that are doing this. And again, to be fair, there's way more, just if you were to, you know, go down the list, way more NGOs that are connected to the, you know, United States government that are routinely getting caught doing the, you know, the National Endowment for Democracy, which, you know, former CIA director said, oh, well, basically the NED can just do what we couldn't do all those years ago, and we can get away with it legally now. But the same, there's a Republican and Democratic version of this, Tech Camp. I mean, the list goes on. There's so many of these NGOs. There's not that many Russian NGOs that are, you know, cropping up in, I don't know, America or in Europe that are, you know, fomenting these sort of things. So they're very careful about how they kind of play around with that. And again, you know, they're constantly talking about how, oh, you know, Russia spends so much money, whereas the BBG, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is the, you know, they're the sort of head group that controls RFERL, Voice of America, Radio Marti, Radio Free Asia, Al Hora, a whole, you know, list of propaganda things. 30 times, they receive 30 times more money than what Russia allocates for their propaganda. And you're talking about, you know, you have this great quote with John Kerry where he says in a straight face, Russia spends all this money on media. We don't have any, but we don't spend any money, and we don't have any, you know, media outlet that broadcasts in Russia to tell the Russians the truth, with a straight face. When you can go to RFERL, they're constantly broadcasting in Russian. So, you know, they're playing very fast and loose with the truth. And what's really shocking, again, is that no one is calling them out on this. No one is kind of standing up and saying, you know, all of these guys that we universally, Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, universally kind of, you know, collectively said, you know, the neocons are kind of nutty. They're dangerous even for us, you know?
Yeah.
Or at least if you, even if you're a hardcore, you know, you loved George Bush, you can at least understand that the term neocon, that these people, they have a negative connotation. We're not going to win elections by, you know, parading around Dick Cheney or Paul Wolfowitz. These guys are tainted. And yet, all of these same people are coming and they're taking mostly from the, you know, hipster media. And they're co-opting them or, you know, offering them fame and fortune. And they're everywhere and no one is calling them out on this. So it's really, again, just a fascinating thing. I mean, we could probably, you know, talk for hours about the neocons. But I just wanted to mention two quick things. And then I'll throw it back to you for any kind of, you know, anything you want to just sort of round off the conversation with. But just a couple things, again, on the whole, you know, that the neocon agenda is really about Russia. You say in the film, the last public letter that PNAC wrote, and PNAC would write lots of these public letters urging, you know, urging like Bill Clinton to carpet bomb Yugoslavia and other countries. The last public letter that they wrote, knowing this is the end of PNAC, was to NATO and the EU. It had the most signatories and a lot from the, you know, left liberal interventionist sort of crowd. It was all about Russia. It was all about that we need to confront Russia, that Russia is – we need to play up the idea that Russia is eroding civil liberties, that we can isolate them. And they later sent a very similar letter to Obama. So again, this is really very much about confronting Russia and using proxies and things like that. And just one other thing too, because I just found it amazing – you know, we're talking about these, you know, conspiracies and, you know, shadow government, who's controlling all these sort of things. There's a great, again, a great clip that you have in here of Robert Kagan, and he's at a university lecture, I believe it was in Florida, and he's asked a question about the Council on Foreign Relations, and, you know, the students say, oh, you know, the CFR is controlling all these sort of things, blah, blah, blah. And he laughs it off, and, oh, yeah, you know, the CFR is just a bunch of old, you know, old white men who just hang out and it's not a big deal. Nothing really goes on there. But then he says, but there are nefarious secretive groups that are out there pulling the strings that you've never even heard of. You know, so like, which, you know, made me think of like the Council for National Policy, which is like, you know, that's like the FBI on steroids. But, I mean, again, there he is admitting that, oh, yeah, there are secret groups. It's not the CFR, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But no, it's interesting. Yeah, the what was the thing you said right before that about what was the point you made right before the thing about Robert Kagan?
Oh, just about the public letter to
NATO. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, what I find fascinating is they always – it's like they have all these agendas already clearly in mind. Mm-hmm. They had them for decades possibly. But you can always see very, really early iterations of these ideas before they're actually like put them into fruition.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, with Iraq, you can find stuff as far back as the mid-90s about how they wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein and do all these things, or with Russia, you can find that NATO EU letter from 2004. And I mean, if you think about it, or was it 2004?
2004, 2005, sometime around there.
Yeah, but I mean, either way, think about that time period. I mean, that was like when we were knee deep in the fucking war on terror still, and here they are wanting to inch up the dialogue already. You know, about creating this rift between us and Russia. So they're very greedy and eager to do these things as quickly as they can, mm-hmm. as early as they can. So I think it's wise for anybody who's worried or who cares about any of the shit we've talked about for this past hour to pay attention to everything these big people and these organizations say, because you never know, they might drop a hint about something that they're going to do 5 years from now, you know, in a letter they release tomorrow. So I think that it's very important to pay attention to that stuff. I mean, you can gather, you know, interesting information from watching their think tank talks, but I think it's a lot of work to do that, and it's boring. So I don't think you have to do that to be really you know, paying attention to what's going on. I mean, I'll probably continue to do that even when I'm done with this movie. I mean, for all I know, I might make a part four, you know, if this keeps going, you know, if there's still a story to be told. I actually had to change part three a lot in the past few months because I realized that this was going to keep ebbing and flowing and morphing. I mean, the Turkish shooting down of the Russian jet was sort of like, wow, like I don't know if I can actually end this movie where it is now. Like I am going to have to keep going on this. And so that's what I'm doing now. I'm, you know, it's pretty open still as to how it's going to close out, at least chapter three.
I was just going to echo all of that. And again, I'm so glad that you are continuing to study the neocons because they really never went away. They just rebranded themselves. They've opened up as to what a neocon can be. And again, I think they are one of the most powerful political forces at work in Washington and around the world. Obviously now, Elliot Higgins, Peter Pomerantz, you know, these are Europeans that are getting involved.
Yeah.
So it's so important to pay attention to these sort of things. And again, too, it's the media infiltration. You know, we're seeing, again, the consolidation of media. You know, it's not just enough for them to sort of have their think tanks. Now they've got to control the media outlets. And they're controlling the sort of, you know, Daily Beast is pretty mainstream. But now they're Vice. Now they're looking at people like Elliot Higgins and Michael Weiss who are, you know, they're creating their own news sites. But they want to still control those as well. And again, and it all kind of comes back to Russia. We gotta destroy Russia. Robbie, quickly, where can everyone go to watch A Very Heavy Agenda Part 2?
Well, A Very Heavy Agenda Part 2 comes out on Friday, January 15th. And you can go to averyheavyagenda.com. And on that website, you'll see a link to the trailer, a trailer embed for Part 2. And on that trailer embed is you can click the top right corner of it to watch it now on demand. That won't be active until Friday. But that's one way people can watch it is just video on demand streaming online. You can also download it. I'm also offering sort of a package deal. If you buy the DVD, which is actually going to be out February 1st, it's going to be a little later than the digital stream. If you buy a DVD of Part 2, I'll also give you a free download and streaming link to the film online as well. And then on that same website, averyheavyagenda.com, you can order Part 1 of A Very Heavy Agenda and stream it as well.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I can't wait to have you back on to discuss Part 3 and you know, maybe even Part 4 as well. But Robbie Martin, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Pierce. I really appreciate it.
Okay, so that was our conversation with Robbie Martin. If you enjoyed this podcast and you'd like to hear some more of my work, then please go to PorkinsPolicyReview.com. There, of course, you can find every episode free for download. You can follow through the RSS feed or through email blasts. You can always follow me on Twitter at PorkinsPolicy. And, of course, please do subscribe to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/1138Porkins. And just a quick reminder, everyone out there, of course, NewsBud is going to be launched, and that is the new media project that myself and Sibel Edmonds, Pepe Escobar, Bill Conroy, Peter B. Collins, a whole bunch of other people are involved with, and I hope that all of you will be able to donate starting on February 14th, which is, of course, the launch of the Kickstarter campaign. And if you're curious about some more information on this, then go to BoilingFrogsPost.com. Sibel has a couple of podcasts up right now. She's got one with her and Peter B. Collins and Pepe Escobar. There's another one also with Pepe and Peter B. That James Corbett did. And I'll be recording some stuff with Peter B. Collins and Sibel Edmonds in the near future. There's going to be a lot more little updates and podcasts talking about this. And if you do want to stay up to date with everything, then there is an email list that you can follow. There's no obligation. You don't have to donate or anything like that. It's just if you want to, you know, stay up to date and all the information about NewsBud, that will be coming out in the next couple of weeks as we get prepared for the launch of the Kickstarter. And of course, you can follow that at BoilingFrogsPost.com. But if you also go to my website, on the left-hand side of the website, just underneath my Twitter feed, there is a button that says Join NewsBud. And if you click on that, you'll be brought to the website where you can sign up for email updates and all that sort of stuff. So please do that if you are interested. And of course, I will be talking to you very soon.
You may be surprised, people in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists bound to lose.
Yes,
all you fascists bound to lose. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Across the fields where a million fascists died, you're bound to lose.